ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
US President-elect Donald Trump says he won't rule out using military or economic coercion to take control of Greenland and the...
You have approximately 45,000 people there. People really don't even know if Denmark has any legal right to it. But if they do, they should give it up because we need it for national security. That's for the free world. I'm talking about protecting the free world.
President Trump wants Greenland for the security of the free world. But Greenland is a self-governing, autonomous country within the Kingdom of Denmark. And as the Danes have made very clear, they don't have the right to sell Greenland because Greenland is owned by the people of Greenland. But Trump is not the first US president who wanted to buy Greenland. This is a story that has a much longer history. Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince, and in this episode of Rear Vision, the story of Greenland and America's many attempts to buy and control it. Greenland is the largest island on Earth and situated in one of the most strategically important parts of the planet, the Arctic.
If you look at the map, Greenland looks enormous and it is big. It is situated between Canada, the United States, and Iceland. It reaches almost as far as the North Pole. It's mostly covered in ice, so about 95% of it is covered in a massive ice sheet, and all the settlements are around the coast. Yet in this massive landmass, you only have about 57,000 inhabitants. Rachel Lerner-Johnstone is Professor of Law at the University of Akureyri in Iceland and at Ellesmeyjarsaafik, the University of Greenland. Greenland is, of course, part of the North American continent, but like the rest of the North American continent, was colonized by Europeans. In Greenland's case, that was much earlier than when Columbus arrived in Guanahani. There were people in Iceland, so it was all part of this sort of Nordic realm. And the Norse traveled from Iceland to Greenland and then over to Canada. So it was from the east settled by people from Iceland. But it was also settled from the north by Inuit coming. So the same people that began in the far east of Russia crossed into what is now Alaska, through Canada, and down into Greenland. There was different waves of Inuit immigration into Greenland. So the current Inuit population descends from around 1,000 years ago. So kind of overlapping around the time the Norse were moving there. The Inuit survived and continued to thrive in different settlements in the east coast as well as on the west. However, the Icelanders died out. Nobody quite knows exactly why, whether it was by disease or they decided to emigrate. But they died out around the late 1400s, early 1500s. Meanwhile, the Inuit continued to thrive.
The Inuits first encountered the Danes in 1721, when the Norwegian-Danish Kingdom established a trading company and a Lutheran mission in Greenland. And so began over 200 years of Danish colonial rule.
So a couple of centuries later, after the Reformation in Europe, what was then the Norwegian-Danish Kingdom, it was one kingdom, they decided that they needed to evangelize what they thought were the existing Norse, because they would have still been Roman Catholic, but also following, to some extent, Norse mythology. Iceland had converted to Christianity in the year 1000. That was Roman Catholicism. So with the Reformation in Europe, there was a mission to convert the what were thought to be descendants of the Icelanders to Protestantism or Lutheranism. However, Hans Egede, the priest who first traveled and led the mission to Greenland, arrived in 1721, and didn't find any Icelanders or any descendants of the Icelanders, but he did find the Inuit, and he set about trying to convert them with a high degree of success, I would say. I think over 90% of Inuit today in Greenland consider themselves Christian, Lutheran in particular. Then there was all kinds of changes in Europe, many shifts in power and shifts of alliances. So when Norway and Denmark separated, Greenland became part of the Danish kingdom. At that point, there was also Iceland. There was also the Danish West Indies, which are now known as the US Virgin Islands. And we can perhaps come back to that because I think it's an interesting part of the story and US interest in Greenland.
The United States first became interested in Greenland in the middle of the 19th century.
Greenland was the end of the earth for all intents and purposes. In fact, that's the way that the Catholic Church and the Vatican often thought of it. the edge of the map, so to speak. And even after the separation in 1814 between the Danish and Norwegian crowns, Denmark, in this sort of divorce, Denmark gets custody, so to speak, of Greenland. But it's not a territory that attracts a terrible amount of attention until the middle of the 19th century. And it's part of this process of modernity, of the world becoming smaller as a result of steamships, of railroads, the Industrial Revolution, telegraph lines. John Mitchum, Chair of the Department of History, and the Albert Labriola Endowed Chair in the Humanities at Duquesne University. In the 1860s, the United States becomes interested in Greenland, not necessarily because at the time it was seen as having a lot of raw material and strategic need. It was part of this broader effort of manifest destiny that, of course, is part of the narrative of westward expansion. And so in 1867, American Secretary of State William Seward famously purchases Alaska from the Russian Empire for a cost of like $25 million, less than about $200 million in today's currency. But just as importantly, Seward approaches the Danish government about purchasing Greenland and purchasing Iceland. They're not interested. They are interested. The money is negotiated, and then ultimately, as a result of some of the political imperatives taking place in the United States. This is after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. This is in the midst of the bitter political struggles of Reconstruction. Ultimately, it's the United States that loses interest. The issue reemerges in the United States in 1910, briefly, when there are some backdoor conversations taking place about the possible purchase of Greenland. But it's not until the First World War that the topic really becomes of importance, not just in the United States, but in several other European and indeed British imperial countries as well. And it's the First World War that marks this watershed of the sort of great imperial annexationist schemes, the plotting, the backroom deals that are taking place in an attempt to sort of redraw global boundaries.
The early years of the 20th century, European and Western powers were attempting to acquire as much territory as possible, especially any territory that could be used as a naval base. The United States became interested in three islands in the Caribbean, just off the coast of Puerto Rico, known as the Danish West Indies.
During the early part of the 20th century, the United States and all of the major powers, the desire for naval bases becomes an insatiable goal. This is arguably part of the United States' imperialist ambitions in the Pacific. We can think here about the annexation of Hawaii in 1898, the Spanish-American War, which of course creates an American empire. Americans don't like to talk about having an empire, right? These are territories, these are protectorates, but it's an empire. The early 20th century, the United States also becomes concerned about the possibility that European possessions in the Western Hemisphere, particularly those of the smaller countries like Denmark, could fall prey in time of war to a great power, potentially a naval rival. And in particular, they're concerned about Germany. And so during the run-up to the First World War, there begins to be conversations, and it's actually not about Greenland to begin with, it's about the Danish West Indies, what is today the United States Virgin Island. There is concern that Germany could somehow or another, whether through conquest or purchase, gain control of the Danish West Indies, because in the First World War, German submarines don't have the ability to conduct offensive operations on the east coast of the United States. Nobody's worried about a German U-boat showing up in New York Harbor. That'll come in time, right, in the Second World War. But on the other hand, if Germany were to possess potential bases close to the American seaboard that they could use as jumping off point for offensive operations, this poses a real threat to the United States, even though at the early part of the war, of course, it's a neutral power. So in 1915, 1916, the State Department enters into negotiations with the Danish government to purchase the Danish West Indies. And the Danish government, of course, is both bankrupt as well as worried about a possible German invasion. Denmark is neutral, but of course, they're always concerned about the possibility of Germany breaching its neutrality laws and taking possession of the country. So they're quite willing customers. But as part of this, they also extract from the United States a pledge to recognize Danish claims. Here's the Danish diplomatic trick of sorts. Part of these negotiations, they extract this pledge that the United States will recognize Danish claims to sovereignty over Greenland.
So the United States, as part of its deal with Denmark, recognized Denmark's sovereignty over Greenland. But in 1941, when Germany occupied Denmark, the United States, with the cooperation of the Danish ambassador in Washington, made the decision to militarily occupy Greenland for security reasons.
The Second World War was really a game changer because during the war, Greenland had two types of military strategic importance. Firstly, weather measurements. If you knew what the weather was like in Greenland, you would know what the weather was like in Europe 48 hours later. And that's pretty important when you have a war to run. So for that reason, Germany tried to establish weather stations in Greenland, and the United States tried to prevent Germany from having weather stations in Greenland. My name is John Rabeck Clemensen. I am an associate professor at the Royal Danish Defence College, where I'm also the head of research for the Center for Arctic Security Studies. When Denmark was then occupied in 1940 by the Germans, that created a very complicated situation for Greenland and for the Faroe Islands. In 1941, the United States occupied Greenland, and there were actually skirmishes between German soldiers who were sent to establish weather stations in eastern Greenland and American troops. That's the time where Greenland begins to have a real strategic importance, and that's heightened immensely during the Cold War, where Greenland played a key role for the defense of North America and for strategic deterrence.
So just going back at the end of World War II, did they give Greenland back to Denmark at the end of the war?
Oh, that's a super complicated question. In order to understand it, you have to go back a little bit. What happens when Denmark gets occupied by Germany in 1940 is that the Danish ambassador to Washington, Henrik Kofman, he goes rogue and he acts like a government in exile de facto. And he says that the government in Copenhagen is illegitimate, it's under German control, and therefore it cannot make decisions regarding Greenland. And he then tries to use the American interest in Greenland as a bargaining chip to get the Americans to recognize him as the de facto representative of Denmark in the United States. And when the US then decides to occupy Greenland, they make an agreement, and in that agreement, there's an article that says that the United States has a right to be in Greenland, and it doesn't specify when they have to leave. And therefore, after the end of the Second World War, the Americans claim that there's still a threat to the North American continent, this time from the Soviet Union, and therefore they will have to stay. And that creates a really, really unpleasant situation for the government in Copenhagen, because on the one hand, they need to have a good relationship with the US, right? The US is basically dominating the international order at that time. At the same time, they really want the Americans out because they want to reestablish Danish sovereignty over Greenland. But the issue is sort of settled when Denmark joins NATO in 1949. And actually, one of the reasons why Denmark joins NATO is that the Americans insist that Denmark has to join NATO because of Greenland. Denmark actually at that time was working together with Sweden and Norway to form an independent Scandinavian defense union that would be outside of the East-West divide. But the Americans said to Copenhagen, basically, you can have your Scandinavian union, but we're keeping Greenland. So, so Greenland comes with us, right? For that reason, Denmark eventually decided to become part of NATO.
Vast, inaccessible reaches of the frozen Northland assume new importance as news comes of a strategic air base only 900 miles from the North Pole. Construction of the base at Thule in Greenland was begun 18 months ago. While not fully completed, it is ready and working. Northernmost outpost of our jet fighter defense and an obvious staging ground for our intercontinental bombers. An airborne task force prepared the way for an army of construction workers that followed. The importance of the base is best understood by looking at the map. It is only 2,700 miles to Moscow, so Thule could play a vital role in deterring aggression.
Greenland played a slightly different role for the Americans during the early Cold War. They still had an interest in weather stations, but now Greenland became important because they could use it to stage long-range bombers. Nuclear deterrence at that time was based on bombers, and the big challenge was there's a long distance from mainland North America to the Soviet Union. But if you staged the bombers in Greenland, the distance was significantly smaller. So the Americans wanted to maintain a presence in Greenland at that time. And the presence was smaller than it was during the Second World War, but it still was quite significant. The American presence during the Cold War kind of opens Greenlandic society to the world. Before the Second World War, it was virtually impossible to go to Greenland as an outsider. But with the American presence, Greenland suddenly becomes part of the Western world. And it becomes obvious to Greenlandic leaders that the world is interested in them and they can have a relationship to the world.
From the beginning, I think the Americans were the first one who sort of opened Greenland up to the world.
Naya Nathanielsen is a minister in the Greenlandic government, responsible for natural resources, business, trade, and gender equality.
Because the Danish, they had sort of a more steady grip on Greenland and Greenlanders and our relations to the outside world, but that was cut under World War II. And I think many Greenlanders found that with the American presence, we were opened up to the outside world in a new way. So in some aspects, that has been a positive relation. We do see ourselves as part of the Western Alliance, of course, of NATO. So I think we do have common ground with Americans without ever being in a position where we found that the American presence should increase much in Greenland.
You're with Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince, and we're looking at the history of Greenland and America's attempts to buy it. After World War II, Denmark did regain sovereignty over Greenland, but the people of Greenland had almost no say in that decision or any other decision relating to Greenland. By the 1970s, though, there was a push within Greenland for greater autonomy and a say for Greenlanders in how Greenland was run.
There are probably three main periods following the war. In 1946, Greenland was registered as a colony formally, or a non-self-governing territory at United Nations. But in 1954, following the new constitution in 1953, it was removed from that list. And that has been quite controversial. It's been criticized in Greenland and elsewhere because the Greenlanders were not directly consulted. They had provincial council. So they had a group of local people who were elected, but they weren't elected from all regions of Greenland. So there was no representation of East or North Greenland at that time. And it was also led by a Danish governor. So it has been heavily criticized. But formally, Denmark considered from that point onwards that Greenland was a county, so a municipality, rather than a colony. This also meant that the UN stopped monitoring the situation in Greenland. In the 1970s, you have a kind of growth in a movement towards more recognition of indigenous rights. You also have a global movement on indigenous rights taking off. Not that it hadn't existed before, but it's suddenly getting traction within the United Nations system. In 1973, Denmark joins the European Community. But in Greenland, there was a vote against joining the European Community. In the Faroe Islands, there was also a vote against joining the European Community. But because the Faroe Islands already had home rule, Denmark could join the European Community while leaving the Faroe Islands out, and that remains the case today. But Greenland, because they only had status as a county, were dragged into the European Community. And that created a lot of resistance in Greenland because of the value of their fish exports. And suddenly they were part of a common fisheries policy that meant that anyone from all the other European states at that time could come and fish fairly liberally, and the quota was shared. That really sort of pushed the momentum in Greenland towards more what became Home Rule, saying, no, we need to start taking control of our own affairs. So as you mentioned, in Home Rule Act, they have more power. They have their own parliament, which then creates its own government, and they have power over what you might think of as domestic affairs. Home Rule was fairly successful in Greenland running its own affairs. I think confidence building, the establishment of the University of Greenland, the Lissimitsofik, and the increasing education of Greenlanders. Before then, they had to travel to Denmark for education. So then in 2009, there's more of a move towards seeing Greenlanders not just as an indigenous people, which Denmark had viewed them as or recognised them as, but seeing them as a people in international, which means a colonial people. And in 2009, not only does the Self-Government Act give them much broader powers, including the right to take over all the subsurface or the mineral rights, it also recognises the Greenlanders as a people in international law. And that means that Denmark recognises the Greenlanders have a right to complete self-determination. That is, a right to decide their own way of government and any alliances they want to have. So Denmark has recognised that Greenlanders have a right to independence if they choose it. They have a right to continue in the current form or share a different kind of alliance. So that's something that's on the table. That is the story of the increasing recognition of Greenlanders' rights to govern themselves.
By the early 1990s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, the United States lost interest in Greenland.
the Americans closed all of their military installations in Greenland fairly quickly. And today they only have one main military installation, which is the Pituffik Space Base, or which was formerly known as the Thule Space Base, as Thule Air Base. So after the end of the Cold War, the US became preoccupied with other issues. And for a long time, the only time that was Greenland played any real strategic importance for the US was in the late 90s and right after the turn of the millennium, where the United States wanted to use the Thule Air Base as part of their missile defense system, and they needed to do some upgrades. And in this period, you also begin to see the Greenlanders getting a say, at least a little say, over some of the security and defense issues pertaining to the American presence. Greenland gets what's called home rule in 1979, and then in the 80s and 90s, they insist on also getting a say over questions pertaining to the American presence in Greenland, which results in what's called the Jalliku Agreement in 2004, where the US and Denmark recognizes that the Greenlanders should be consulted about questions related to the American presence. They establish two bodies where the Greenlanders can sit in together with Denmark and the United States, and where they can discuss ways in which the US can compensate the Greenlanders for the American presence by supporting education and mining and a host of other issues. With the end of the Cold War, the American interest diminishes and the Greenlandic influence over these questions is increased. So there's a fundamental shift with the end of the Cold War.
So when does the United States start to become interested in Greenland again?
I think Greenland's always been important, or at least since World War II, Greenland has been literally on the map, as well as figuratively on the map. It's been a great awareness of its security position. We talk about the GIUK gap, so Greenland, Iceland, United Kingdom gap in the North Atlantic. So Greenland is very, very important for NATO defense, but also partly because of climate change, partly because of improving technologies, it is becoming more realistic to have mining of a lot of very, very valuable resources. So there's all kinds of resources in Greenland, including rare earth elements that are important for the energy transition, precious gems such as rubies and diamonds, iron, coal, base metals like copper, tin, lead and zinc. So there's a lot of resources out there that other countries have their eye on. So I would say that the United States is interested, of course, Denmark, but also the European Union. There's interest from China, maybe less directly interest from Russia. But right now, when it comes to some of these rare earth elements and critical minerals, China has a real market dominance because of its own direct supplies, but also because of its investments elsewhere, in particular in Africa. So there is a kind of attempt to reduce China's dominance by looking for supplies in like stable democratic countries where there is a kind of expectation that human rights will be upheld and workers' rights will be protected and so forth.
The Arctic in general begins to become more strategically important around 2008, where Russia resumes its flights with long-range strategic bombers. And it becomes obvious to the world that climate change will fundamentally change the Arctic and that the Arctic is home to a host of resources. However, it's only with the return of American military interest in Greenland around 2017-18 that Greenland really becomes a hot button issue. From around 2014, various Chinese actors tried to get a presence in Greenland. And I think that is part of the reason why the Americans start becoming interested in Greenland. Also, at the same time, it becomes obvious to the US that while they have been fighting wars in Afghanistan and in Africa and the Middle East, China and Russia have been increasing their presence in the Arctic, and the US has fallen behind militarily, economically, and diplomatically. So during the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, there's a push to regain an American position in the Arctic, generally speaking, and that includes an interest in Greenland. And of course, it all culminates with Donald Trump's first attempt to buy Greenland in 2019.
The US president has postponed a trip to Denmark because the country's prime minister isn't interested in discussing his idea of buying Greenland. Denmark says the idea of selling the island to the US is absurd, but Donald Trump says it's strategically interesting.
We did not condone the rhetoric back then, and buying Greenland, I think many people found offending in Greenland. We are not for sale. We're not a commodity you can buy or sell. We are a people with our own right. We are not Americans. We don't want to be. We're not Danes. We are Greenlanders, and we have a democracy, and we're an ally, and we want that respected and understood. But we also recognize that, of course, the U.S. does have national security interest in Greenland. We do understand our importance for the states in terms of national security. We also understand that we are part of a changing world, new emerging world order, in which we are all trying to find our foothold. Also in 2019, we entered into an agreement with the U.S. State Department on a mineral sector that has been really positive for us. And we have done some great, I think, things and projects with the U.S. State Department, with the U.S. in that regard. And we have been trying for some time to renew that. In terms of tourism, of course, it sparked a lot of interest in Greenland. I think many people were certainly aware that there was something called Greenland, and it has also helped our tourism sector develop. It's not attention you necessarily want in that way, but we did, I think, transcend it into something positive. And our message has been along the same lines this time around, saying, well, we still want to be respected as a democracy, as a country in our own right, but we do still recognize, maybe even more than before, the necessity for the U.S. to have a secure country in Greenland, that we stretch the national security of the states much more to include Greenland in some way or other. We do have military presence in Greenland, and we do recognize this is a necessity in the world today.
You look outside, you have China ships all over the place. You have Russian ships all over the place. We're not letting that happen. We're not letting it happen. And if Denmark wants to get to a conclusion, but nobody knows if they even have any right title or interest. The people are going to probably vote for independence or to come into the United States. But if they did do that, then I would tariff Denmark at a very high level.
The Arctic is becoming strategically important, mainly because we have moved into a period of great power competition. Russia, China, and the US are competing. And the Arctic is strategically important for military reasons, because it lies right where Russian and Chinese missile will fly against North America if there's ever a great power war. It's full of Russian military equipment that the Russians can use in the event of a conflict. But climate change is changing the Arctic, and it is altering the strategic situation in the region. So, for instance, it's opening the what's called the Northern Sea Route, or the Northeast Passage, the sea route between Europe and Asia that goes north of Russia. There you can really see climate change altering the strategic situation. You see Russia investing heavily in military bases and installations in that area, simply because it's an ocean that's opening to their northern front, and any great power needs to be able to control an area like that militarily. So climate change is sort of a background variable. However, the affair about Greenland right now has to do with American fear of especially Chinese encroachments.
John Ravik Clemenson, Head of Research at the Center for Arctic Security at the Royal Danish Defence College. Today's other guests, Rachel Lorna Johnstone, Professor of Law at the University of Greenland. John Mitchum, Chair of the Department of History at Duquesne University. And Naya Nathanielson, Minister in the Greenlandic Government. The sound engineer for this program is Isabella Tropiano. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.